Welcome to the Tuesday Brown Bagger on CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver. As the 2010 Olympics approach, the possibility of civil liberties violations has been cited by a number of community organizations as a major concern, despite assurances from VANOC, government partners, and the Integrated Security Unit that rights would be protected. With 16,500 security personnel scheduled to be part of the largest peacetime operation in Canadian history, impacts are already being felt. Ticketing of residents in the inner city, home and workplace visits of social activists by members of the Integrated Security Unit, and a new bylaw passed by the City of Vancouver, which places the rights of corporate sponsors ahead of the rights of citizens. Those are only a few of the immediate impacts. We're about to hear an event organized by the Impact on Community Coalition, the IOCC. It was called The Right to the City, Civil Liberties, and the 2010 Olympics at SFU Harbour Centre on Monday, September 28th. The panel included David Ebby, Executive Director, BCCLA, Matt Hearn, writer, Stephanie Ratchin, board member of the IOCC, Hersha Walia, social activist, Alyssa Westergaard-Thorpe, Olympic Resistance Network, Jeff Dirksen, SFU professor, and Amjo Hall Chair, IOCC, as the moderator. In this broadcast of the second hour of the event, we begin with Matt Hearn, the writer, followed by the professor Jeff Dirksen, and we continue through a lively question and answer period. All this recorded by CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio with studios in the downtown east side of Vancouver.
Moving right along, Matt Hearn almost wasn't with us today because he had a bad case of pneumonia last week. Mighty Matt Hearn, as he's known, as the founder of the Purple Thistle Writing Center. He founded, co-founded the Commercial Drive Car Free Festival. He teaches at SFU and UBC and is also a writer. So welcome, Matt.
Thanks, folks. Well, I just got a couple of small things to say, and frankly, I don't know how much I can add after super articulate and frankly moving stuff from all you guys. So thanks very much, you guys. That was awesome. I'm hoping I can just add one small thing to the conversation. And some time ago, I got interested in ideas about safety and security. I started noticing, like everybody else, I started noticing security cameras. I started noticing security guards everywhere I turned. I noticed warnings on coffee cups that their contents were hot. I noticed kind of absurd lawsuits and kind of threats of liability. And I just began to notice, in particular, because I hang out with kids every day, is the restriction on public space that began to come up in all kinds of weird ways and kind of unexpected ways. And this is maybe about 10 years ago, and I started thinking about that. I tried to think about the logic behind that, and I tried to start to make, you know, some kind of sense of it. And I was kind of turning it over in my head a little bit. And at the time, I was working at a school in North Vancouver, and this really interesting thing happened. I mean, tragic and interesting thing in some ways is that, so I was working at a public school in North Vancouver, but at a private independent school in the North Vancouver district, a kid fell out of a tree and died. And it was, you know, horrible. It was horrific. It's every parent's nightmare. In response to that incident, though, after a series of kind of scares around liability, the District of North Vancouver and the School Board of North Vancouver banned tree climbing for all kids, which from one level you look at it and you go, okay, I understand that. I understand how in a panic or in terror and fear of lawsuit, and particularly in fiscally challenged climate in North Vancouver schools, you can see how that answer, well, that might be a response. Turn from another just slightly different perspective, you look at it and you think, really? I work for a school that prides itself on the freedom and responsibility that we offer to kids, and I now formally have to disallow kids from climbing trees? How did I get there? How did that happen? And so from there, just that kind of catalyzed for me thinking about creep, about the way that authoritarian control and authoritarian mandates oftentimes creep into our lives sort of on the backs of other stuff, kind of behind things, kind of from a sideways way, and then all of a sudden the culture or the city just has shifted in a fundamental way, and we barely have had a chance to talk about it or notice how the hell that happened. And one of the things, as I started thinking about this and doing some research and some writing about it, was the degree to which safety, security, is contingent. It depends. It's not a thing. And so the same incident can be viewed from very different perspectives in very different kinds of ways. So, you know, you can think of this in many ways, right? Is it trees we should be afraid of, or is it kids who we should be afraid of? Should we ban kids from climbing trees, or should we mourn it? Should we be afraid of aggressive panhandling, or is it poverty that we should be really afraid of? And I think that we need to constantly kind of remind ourselves that the idea of safety, the idea of security, it's not a thing. It's not an artifact. It's contingent. It depends. It depends on context. It's politicized. But so often in conversations, in public conversations about that, the idea of safety is unchallenged. And security just ends up meaning keeping order, keeping things in place, keeping power in place. And I noticed for many years that radicals, that leftists, that anarchists have all kinds of trouble actually addressing that conversation. Well, you know, okay, you don't like cops. Well, why don't you like cops? Well, and then it gets turned on us real quickly where, oh yeah, if you're not doing anything wrong, what are you afraid of? And oftentimes in public conversations, we kind of get stuck. We go, I don't know, screw cops, which is fine, which is good. It's a good answer. But why? How does that logic? And so I got interested in a lot of the conversations, which are, well, how do we begin to think that cops keep us safe? What's the logic behind that? How is it that we begin to think that CCTVs begin to make us secure? And I think that those questions are super important to pay attention to. And I think of this in terms of the Olympics, I'm in this particular way, which is that it's not just the Olympics, right? The Olympics are the thing that we could focus on, and they're like massive. I mean, they're just so freaking ridiculous, right? In so many ways, and so obnoxious, so profoundly obnoxious. But the Olympics didn't come out of nothing. They came out of a neoliberal worldview, and they happened to be the kind of crowning glory of that worldview. But those arguments, that worldview, they're not going to disappear with the Olympics. They're going to be here. And in fact, as several folks have mentioned, is that very oftentimes the things that are brought in supposedly just for the Olympics, well, you know, we need this kind of security measure. We need these extra cops. We need those cameras. We need these kind of restrictions because of the Olympics. But then the Olympics go away and those things are still here. And I experienced this, or I encountered this real viscerally. In 2004, I was heading to the Democratic National Convention in Boston looking to cause a little shit. And I was actually 200 miles away when my car got pulled over and detained. So I never actually made it there. But before the Democratic National Convention, it was in 2004, the argument, of course, was, well, that is a sure terrorist threat. That's an absolute obvious terrorist target. And so the city of Boston was absolutely blanketed in all kinds of restrictions on public space, in cops and security cameras, in security guards, and all kinds of stuff, you know, just the stuff you might imagine, because obviously it was a terrorist threat. And the answer was, it's just for the DNC. It's all going to go back to normal after the DNC. And, of course, literally 2 days after the convention finished and everybody went home and all the delegates left, the Boston police chief said, well, I've got all these cameras now. I'm not going to put them in a freaking box. I think he left the freaking part out, but and so now the city of Boston is covered in cameras. And it's one more way that a worldview and an epistemology and a politics gets advanced a little further, and all of a sudden the culture and the city just moves a little farther ahead, and we can't figure out how we got there and how do we resist that. And that's consistently and the mode of operation for all these kind of circuses, right? They have their own logic, but they also have a larger logic, and they're also embedded in other deeper, more fundamental logics that we have to remember. So I would say that it behooves us to resist the Olympics for all we're worth, resist every part of them, and do everything we can to mess the circus up in any way possible. I think that's absolutely true. But I think it also really behooves us to remember what's left behind, to remember the logic that got us to this point. How do we end up with this shit show on our hands? What was the logic that got us there? What were the arguments that got us there? And what's going to be left behind? And how can we begin to undermine those more fundamental logics? Those more fundamental logics that keep ending us up with a security guard in every library and in every street, and security guards hired by the BIAs walking up and down our streets. How do we end up there? And how do those logics, how can we attack those logics? Not just the event, but actually the logic and the arguments kind of at their root. So I guess I would just say, echo what the good folks here are saying is, man, let's go get them. Let's go get them right now, but let's make sure we get them later too. Thanks. Thanks, guys.
And the final speaker is Jeff Dirksen, who is a professor at SFU and a writer. And I also wanted to take the time to congratulate Jeff for winning an SFU Teaching Award or Research Excellence Award. Anyway, he won some very fancy award today that he's going to tell you about. So,
unfortunately, I won't be competing in the Olympics. But after such a great panel of people who are really giving us a material sense of the not only just a material sense of the kind of clamp downs and transformations and that are going to be happening around the Olympics, but also pointing to the kind of absurdity of, as well, and which really can kind of unearth the humor of it, because when the contradictions run so deep, at a certain point, irony kicks in as a way of making sense of it. So some of the language that's being used, obviously, is completely ironic and kind of hilarious, but at the same time points towards a really problematic aspect of not only what's happening, but how it cuts against our kind of common senses and the way that we think about the city. So I just had four quick points I wanted to make, which I'll echo what people have said already. And a couple of the points are about space and how we think about space and perhaps what space might even be, because a lot of these the struggles and the clampdowns that are happening in the way that people are thinking of organizing is deeply spatial. And by that, I mean that it takes place in space, but it's also is productive of space. It makes space. So if we think of space as a process rather than space as an existing container, we start to think that space is made by particular activities. And then that allows us to think of a way that public space doesn't just exist, but public space is made through particular actions. So a lot of the things that people are talking about tonight is a way of making public, is a way of making space public. On the other hand, we can look at the kind of security clampdowns that are coming and think of that as a way of making private space, of privatizing space. And this becomes a kind of fundamental poles, I think, of the struggle in the way that it can be thought of. So it's a transformation of space. It's not just that public space gets used for something else later, but it gets transformed into privatized space. I think that's what Matt's really pointing towards, like, why do we need security guards in front of all of these different places? Why is this continual guarding of space happening? Why are these places always being restricted? Secondly, I want to point out that by clamping down on the use of public space, by privatizing public space, it limits who becomes understood as public. It limits what kinds of publics can use space. And we already see that through all of the great points that people are making, how you get excluded from the public by doing particular things, things as benign as wearing a T-shirt, things as benign as waving a sign. So again, any change in privatizing space changes who can use it and the notion of what publics are. Because the public doesn't exist. The public's a process as well. So if we think of making the public, this is part of all the democratic actions that people are talking about tonight, I think. Thirdly, I just wanted to add a little bit more about this idea of neoliberalism. Again, a very tricky word, a very clunky word. It's a word that's used a lot more in Latin America and Europe than it is in North America. For instance, the Liberal Party here in British Columbia is a classic neoliberal party, but they will never utter the word. They won't say, we are neoliberals, because neoliberalism implies, again, a lack of freedom. But neoliberalism, let's think of neoliberalism as a kind of globally migrating philosophy and a globally migrating form of governance. So as I was hearing the very kind of powerful stories where people are talking about the different types of clampdowns that are going to happen, I started thinking, oh yeah, when I was in such and such a city, New York in 1999 was the first time that I was at a protest put into a free speech zone. You know, it was kind of like four people and one cop. We were buying him coffees and stuff. New York cops actually don't get paid very much. So you start to see that neoliberalism becomes a governance that circulates globally and it gets picked up. So it comes from certain places and it lands down and it gets picked up by local government. So it's global and local at the same time. So it's not unique to Vancouver. But one thing that's characteristic of neoliberalism as a form of governance, the way that governmentality happens, is that it tends to set up structures that don't work democratically. It tends to try to block collective actions, and it has a love of experts, even if the experts aren't informed in things they're supposed to be experts in. And actually, I think a lot of the laughs that we got tonight were from these kinds of experts who, you know, I did my research, I looked for 5 minutes on the website, and like things that you would never kind of consider yourself an expert as. And I was reading The Province the other day. There's a really great, what begins as a good story about Wendy Pedersen and the great work that the Carnegie Community Center is doing. And Wendy Pedersen says that, you know, we have to have a paradigm shift for how we think about the downtown east side. And we have to start thinking about representing zones of safety and stuff in the downtown east side in a different way. And then to get a response to Wendy, they talked to someone called Bernie Magnan, who's the Vancouver Board of Trade's chief economist. So rather than talking to someone from the city who maybe has some democratic influence where we know who we could go talk to in a sense, they turn to someone who's an economist, not an urbanist, and they say, Bernie Magnan, the Vancouver Board of Trade's chief economist, hadn't read the report that the Carnegie Community Center produced, but said that gentrification doesn't have to be seen as scary. Quote, if the changes that happen in the community are done properly, then it can help people, said Magnan. There are times when the word gentrification is used as a synonym for everything going to high-priced living accommodation rather than just looking at whether it can help contribute to the improvement of the community for everyone, including the existing residents. So what he's saying is that gentrification, the word gentrification doesn't mean gentrification, and that gentrification is not actually gentrification. But I'm saying all this without actually knowing what I'm talking about because I didn't read the report. So I just think that it's a benign, stupid little example from The Province, but why the hell should this person be speaking publicly on this at all? And this shows a shift in the way that neoliberal governance happens. It's a reliance on these experts who obviously don't know what they're supposed to be experts in, but they always say we desperately need to privatize. So the scary part about that everyone's pointed out to very effectively and dramatically, I think, is that after we have the moment of exception of the Olympics, not only do the cameras stay and all the other infrastructure of surveillance, which has led actually to quite fun arts programs and artistic practices. Like there's a group in New York that does tours where they lead you around the city, taking you on the route that where you'll be surveilled the least by different cameras and stuff. So there's ways of turning this right to the city into a different type of right as well. But after the Olympics are gone and all of the cameras are still here, what's left as well is a form of doing governance, a neoliberal form of making decisions. And that decision-making increasingly means asking certain experts their opinions. So if you want an opinion on whether it's a good time to buy a house or some sort of urban question, they turn to the condo king and they ask him, what's the condo king think? They turn to an economist to say that gentrification is nothing to worry about. So I think that'll be, unfortunately, the legacy of the games will be that there's a shift in the structure of how decision-making gets made within the city. I'm really happy that the people who are on the panel here have been totally on the ball on that, obviously, and totally persevering in actually asking for stronger forms of kind of participatory democracy. And then simply my last point is that tonight we've kind of been hovering around a little bit, and but also zoning right into this notion of the idea of the right to the city. And we've talked a little bit about David Harvey, who's an urban geographer, who really picked up on the notion of the right to the city, and that the right of the city is not just the right to have access to public space, but really is the right to imagine the city in an image that you would like to see it happen in. It's really also, it has this kind of imaginative engagement. There's some really good interviews with David Harvey on the web at redpepper.org and through Monthly Review at their MR zine. And he'll talk about the ways that he sees neoliberalism taking shape. But just, and pardon me for my teacherly moment here, but there's Harvey's drawing from this French philosopher, Henri Lefebvre, who lived for a long time and in Paris and really worked through all the different changes and eruptions in Paris. This is a really good introduction to Lefebvre's thought, simply called Henri Lefebvre, A Critical Introduction by Andy Merrifield. Really readable, really engaging. And what's so wonderful with Lefebvre is that for like 60 years of his life, he absolutely railed against the control of the city, he absolutely railed against the way that the textures of the city were being erased. He railed against the way that this kind of lack of imagination of the city was erasing all of this production of space, all of this from the ground up kind of activity. And I think Lefebvre is wonderfully inspirational at the moment. And will supply the exact kind of pointed analysis that adds to the kind of thing that we've been talking tonight. So pardon my teacherly moment, but thank you.
We're going to move on. I'm going to ask a couple of questions of the panelists, and we're also going to open up the microphones. And the way it'll work is we'll take three questions or comments in a row and ask whichever panelists want to comment on those after that. So I'll just begin with a question. In some ways, when the Olympics started here in Vancouver with the promises of an inner-city inclusive commitment statement, there was a plebiscite where about 64% of people supported it. As the years went by, a lot of the promises around civil liberties and housing haven't been met. We have very weak tenancy legislation. There's a fear of evictions as we get closer to 2010. I think to some degree, could there be an argument that the games have been so egregiously bad in terms of their organization, in terms of what was originally promised, that this was going to be a first socially sustainable bid, that if they've been so bad, that perhaps a legacy of them could be that we will have a more critical citizenry, a more critically engaged civil society, because everyone will be impacted by the negative elements of the Olympics.
I think that that your question is a good one, Anne, but I think that it's countered by the consideration of the concentration of media that we experience in the Lower Mainland, that a small number of companies own most of the major media outlets, that those companies are primarily Olympic sponsors, and that unfortunately most of the stories that get reported tend to be from the point of view of the Olympics are awesome, and then there's a paragraph at the end, but, you know, so-and-so from this organization says we need to be careful about X, you know, and it kind of gets in there at the tail end, but there are many stories that are not told. And there's just not a huge interest in covering it. And with that said, though, I would like to tip my hat again to a couple reporters, one of who is here from the TAI, Jeff Dembecki and Bob Mackin from 24, who are really doing an exceptional job of a critical and investigative reporting that you just don't see anymore. As far as their work goes, we'll see an increase in engaged politic, but as far as mainstream media, that's definitely a challenge.
And while we bring up the very valid point about media and appreciating the people in the media in Vancouver that do a great job, since I have an audience here, I'd like to take the opportunity to remind people that there are certain people like Jeff Lee, who writes the well-publicized Olympic blog for the Vancouver Sun, which is, of course, an Olympic corporate sponsor. And Jeff Lee also does freelance work on the side writing promotional material for VanOck. So when you read your average news and you talk to people that read that type of news, and you can understand where they're coming from in their understanding of the Olympics and the impacts because everything that they're getting is so distorted, But I do think that the legacy of the Olympics in most towns that are visited by it are increased organization between different communities that were affected and damaged by the Olympics. I'm hoping something good can come out of that in Vancouver. There's certainly people around the world that have dealt with the Olympics and had them in their community that continue to help other cities resist the bids, organize against holding the Olympics in their communities, which is fantastic. But when you actually think about the legacy of the Games, honestly, what it made me think of was that episode of The Simpsons where they steal a car. They're off to go visit the World's Expo, the World's Fair. They get an old map, and they're off to, like, some city in the States to see the World's Fair. They're so excited. And they get there, and, of course, the World's Fair was maybe 20 years ago, and the great dome that they're expecting to see that'll be wonderful and delightful and exciting is now a dilapidated wig museum. So most places that have had the Olympics, they have these problems. A luge track, a velodrome. What are you going to do with this? Where's the legacy could be social housing, you know, increased shelter beds as promised in order to sway people to vote during the bid. But I don't think that's ever the intention. The intention has never actually been, we'll bring the Games, we'll increase your housing more. It's the carrot that they dangle in front of the public so that the developers can get what they want, which is really the legacy of the Games.
The microphones are open if people have questions or comments. Garvin.
Good evening.
I just wanted to mention Garvin Schneider is on a week-long fast. It's week 39 of the 2010 Homelessness Hunger Strike today. So those of you sitting beside him, watch him. He might try to eat your head after this. So.
Yes, I've got recordings of my stomach growlings for all of you later. I wanted to ask Mr. Ebby particularly. My big concern is for events that were already were established in our community beforehand, the annual Women's March, Poverty Olympics, on home ground, which is the homeless festival. These are events that our community has put forward to build spirit within our own community. Yet, will we be able to partake in those, especially during the event? And again, you were saying that, you know, this is a sign that I carried in the Poverty Olympics and some of those other community events. Mr. Ebby saying, you know, this is a no. Is this correct? This contravenes the can't have a placard.
Oh yeah, that's definitely a no.
That's a definite no. Having any Olympic goodies that I'm not licensed to carry, that's a no.
Is it celebratory or not?
With a glowing heart, but then again, I don't have, you know.
I think it's all in the attitude.
That's a no, my cowbell. But my biggest concern is for those of us, the programs like the Hope in Shadows and the Megaphone Magazine, which are income generators for low-income and marginalized people, but are also established programs within our communities that will be either sanctioned or deterred by the security measures implemented into the Games. How can we, people in the community, protect ourselves to be able to do these things, to have the Poverty Olympics, these events that we already, how have other cities or other communities impacted by the event, how were the strategies that they were able to keep their community events still alive?
Great. Thank you very much, Garvin. Go ahead, Dave, if you wanted to take a stab at that.
I think the issue you raised about Megaphone and Hope in Shadows is really important because there are very clear provisions in the host city agreement and in the clean venue agreement about restrictions on buskers, the bylaws as well, restrictions on street sellers, creating these zones of exclusion where you won't be able to sell, actually. And where even mainstream publications like the Free Dailies are worried that they won't be able to distribute their free newspapers, that only the Olympic sponsor newspapers will be allowed to be distributed in these zones that cover about 40 city blocks. So there's a huge area of exclusion, and I think that's a very important issue. How do you protect yourself? That is a very good question. One would hope that our city council that was elected on treating homeless people and people who are struggling with in various ways with respect and dignity would find a place for the various vendors within the zones of exclusion that are set up. But certainly the way the bylaws are drafted, I don't have a lot of hope in that regard. But it would be interesting to try to get some assurances from them in advance. And if you don't mind, Garvin, I'm going to pass the mic over to Harsha to address the February 14th march, which seems to me to be a very, very pressing downtown Eastside civil liberties issue.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You are listening to Right to the City, Civil Liberties and the 2010 Olympics, recorded at SFU Harbor Center on Monday, September 28, 2009. The panel was organized by Impact on Community Coalition and hosted by Am Johal.
Yeah, I think it's a hard question in terms of what would happen with the Memorial March. Also, like you mentioned, the Poverty Olympics and On Home Ground and other things that are planned specifically in the East Side. I think it's largely speculation as to what will happen on Feb 14th, for example. The Downtown East Side Power of Women group, which is, for people who are not aware, a group that's based at the Downtown East Side Women's Center, and its membership is entirely of women residents of the Downtown East Side and the neighborhood, drafted a petition approximately a week ago calling on Vaisu, Vanock, the RCMP, and city officers to ensure that the Feb 14th march route, date, time, and basically the march, the entire kind of way that the march proceeds, would not be controlled or changed because they'd previously been requesting changes. And also to demand as part of that, because, you know, it's hard to separate out these moments like the Feb 14th march or the Poverty Olympics from these broader things that we're talking about. So the second demand was that the Olympics not forcibly evict or displace any person in the Downtown East Side or any other community in BC, which we know is already happening. And so the response to that is that on last Friday, the City of Vancouver issued a special bulletin. And in that bulletin, they said that the time, they're confirming that the time and the route will not be changed of the Feb 14th Memorial March, which is, of course, in response to this huge outcry. In about 2 weeks, we had over 2,000 petition signatures. And media had picked up the story, although there was no press release issued. And just this general outcry because the Feb 14th march is, of course, incredibly sacred to Downtown Eastside residents and women in the neighborhood, but the broader Vancouver kind of community since it's been going on for approximately 19 years. But, you know, I think there's still a significantly healthy skepticism that come closer to Feb 14th. There are all kinds of changes that might be demanded. They're not kind of reneging on this idea that the Hastings Corridor is vital for so-called Olympics traffic. And so, you know, things that might seem minor, but they're really not. So asking for changes in the stops, and the stops in the Memorial March signify where women were last seen or specific kind of memories and commemorations that happened. So I think the Memorial March is somewhat particular in that the city is overly attempting to accommodate or appearing to accommodate. But at the same time, come Feb 14th, there's no way to predict what will happen. And my prediction is that they're likely going to say that it was hijacked by anti-Olympics protesters to brutally repress it. Because last year there was aerial surveillance of the Feb 14th Memorial March. There was an increased police presence of the Memorial March. And so, you know, I would be really worried for everything given the already heightened climate of repression in the Downtown East Side and police violence and beat cops and all of that, that will continue during the Olympics, although there will be a perception that that's not happening from their end.
Yeah. I'll take the next two questions in a row and I'll ask the panel.
Sure, a quick question. I think I read, it was in the Globe and Mail just a couple of days ago, that the what was described as the first significant challenge to the restrictive laws will take place in Victoria in conjunction with the launching of the torch run. October 30th, I think, was the date mentioned. Does anyone have more information on that? Because what was described was a very conscious effort by anti-Olympic organizers in Victoria to prepare a challenge to defy the police to arrest people for speaking their minds on the Olympics at the event. So if that is going to take place, then I think it's a very important thing that we be aware of and support. I do think that these Olympics are already serving as a catalyst of change to our political process. I've seen opinion in the large industrial workplace where I work in aerospace shifting for all the reasons and more that have been described on the platform. But I think it's a pretty big change that has to happen when we consider that the progressive parties in this province particularly the opposition party in Victoria, has bought into this, we've got some pretty significant change that has to happen. And so I very much look forward to all of the organizing work that we're going to be doing to serve as a very important catalyst, because, boy, is change needed when you look at what's been the response to these games in the in the official world of politics. It's very disappointing and is really unacceptable.
Great. Thank you. Jane, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jane Bowie. I'm a Cope School trustee on the school board. There's a couple things I wanted to raise. One is that our board, which is a Cope Vision board, and I think you could effectively call us Olympic Skeptic Board. We've been dealing with the fact that there's been a huge influx by VANEC and associated groups infiltrating the schools to bring their propaganda into the schools. It's a very difficult thing for us to deal with, because a lot of it is done one-on-one with the individual schools. But the one thing that people, particularly the resistance organizers should know, and the civil liberties organizations should know, is that our board, our official position and our direction is that all education that is done around the Olympics should be balanced with talking about the impacts of the Olympics in terms of housing, in terms of civil liberties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those should all be dealt with in the classrooms and in the schools at the same time. So that's an opening. That's an opening to any of you that are involved in that work to approach schools. And if you run into any resistance from administrators in being able to do that, to contact me at the board, and I'll try and open up those doors, because it's really important that we do that. The other thing is just is one thing that I don't think people are aware of, and that's that David Lamb Park, which is one of the live city venues, is being utilized for a whole year. That is LC Roy Elementary. That's their playground. That's their playing fields. They are not allowed to use it for this entire school year. That's an agreement that was made by the previous Parks Board and VANOC without any consultation with the school, with the school board whatsoever. And we've worked like crazy to try and get that overturned, and we weren't able to. And that's what's happening. Those students, there's a tiny little triangle that has some playground equipment on it that they'll get to use, but there'll be no place for them to run around, play soccer at recess time, lunchtime. It's gone.
Excuse me, sorry. I'm just going to go to the panel if any of you have any comments on those.
Just to address the first point, which it's certainly true that I think a tenor will be set for the torch relay by the beginning October 30th in Victoria. If anybody's interested, it happens to be going by the legislature at about 5:30 on Friday, October 30th. And I'm sure there'll be lots of fans and critics there as well. So I think that will be a bit of a test for how the police will treat protest regarding the torch relay, especially given the successful protests around the torch relay going around, leading up to Beijing, and what happened during the Spirit Train, which was last year, but that is an event that goes across the country that can certainly highlight various areas of resistance across the country as well. So hopefully people can come out to Victoria and also support what they're doing at No 2010 Victoria. And additionally, the issue about workshop training, as it happens, there's a meeting going on right now tonight elsewhere on the east side discussing youth and educational workshop training to try and get out to counteract some of the programming that the Olympics are putting upon the school system and upon youth, especially considering that they've cut hundreds of thousands of dollars from school budgets, including from athletics, while they're spending $500,000 to inculcate the youth of the schools into the Olympic family. So I think that's a great, worthy effort, and hopefully people can be put together to work together on that.
Any other comments from the panel on those? And then we'll have time for three more questions, and we're going to wrap up.
Jane, thank you for bringing that up. My son and daughter go to Grandview Elementary School on the east side. And one of the things that we noticed was obviously the use of the mascots are something, because my son, I like to think he's politically astute, but he's generally just involved in his little 10-year-old life right now. And so after he came home and he had all these posters of, you know, youth, native youth, snowboarding and, you know, doing that sort of thing. I had to sit down and explain, you know, the history and what the message is, the implicit message behind it. And he got it right away, and he still refused to take down the posters. And I decided not to suppress his voice. But the problem that I had was when we got the consent form this year, because we had made several complaints in our PAC meeting about it. And it's difficult because it doesn't explain, because it's just a standard consent form. Do you consent to have media, you know, your child to be used in media? And our school, of course, is involved in a lot of charitable stuff, a lot of stuff just to get the word out that Grandview needs a, you know, a new play area for it to have it on its grounds. Or so there's a lot of things that can be useful for our community in there. But the difficulty is it's either yes or no, right? So unfortunately, a lot of the parents that I've seen said yes. So I think maybe a little bit more work has to be done into the distinction. I know it might be a little bit late, but it would be helpful for a message to go out to the PAC that possibly when they engaged in that consent form, that could possibly use for Olympic propaganda. So I don't see my son up there on some skateboard poster.
I have Ellen next, and then you. Go ahead.
Ellen Woodsworth, and I have to confess I'm a city councillor, and I can't say that the city council is as strong as the parks board. Thank you, Jane, and school board. Sorry. But I have to say that having people come to city council and demand that everyone has the right to basic right to protest and free speech and the right to have their money spent on housing and education and healthcare and the things that we know are desperately needed in this city and in this province and in this world is really, really, really important. And I've been supporting the people who come to council on these issues and voting against the bylaw changes. And I have to say that some of the bylaw changes, a big hunk of them, have gone to Victoria. And I just asked MLA Jenny Kwan yesterday, had the legislature approved them? And these are some of the bylaws that David Eby was talking about that increase bylaw fines to $10,000 a day and say that you can't hold up those signs that have Olympic words in them. Even if you put them in your own window, they can be stripped down and you can be charged. So they're going to be some point shortly, they're going to be passed at the legislature. They're going to be sent back for the city staff to rewrite, and then they're going to come before council again. So I ask you to be really vigilant, and I ask you every other week, there's a council meeting on Tuesdays, and the agendas are up on the city website, and it's really important that people come and speak out. This is the way the media knows what's happening, and Am's right. They're not, I don't know who else mentioned about the media. There are very, very few progressive media, but the Tyee, there's a few. Carnegie Action Newsletter, there's some great websites that have been mentioned. It's important to get out what people really want to see happening in the city, and they speak out. I'm part of the parliamentary left with Jane and some others. You know, I was part of the extra parliamentary left. We need to be working together, and we need to be standing up to these abuses. And I do believe that some of the things can shift, like the Women's Memorial March has shifted. I don't think they would have come out with that statement if there hadn't been the fight back. And we have to make sure that there continues to be that fight back. And I know so many of us are just, I just came from a Literacy Now event. 40% of Literacy Now has been cut, and their website's going down, you know, 80% cuts to the arts, massive cuts to the schools. I mean, they're attacking us in so many different ways. So it's really important that people, you know, stand up in lots of different ways. Carnegie Action Project is having a demonstration on Friday at about 10:30 in front of the Trade and Convention Center, because the Premier is going to be speaking, and they're going to be protesting the lack of money for affordable housing and for funding for homelessness. So these kinds of things can be you know, joined in and supported. If you take a look at the Union of BC Municipalities website, you can find out when the BC government ministers are hosting all the municipal councillors and mayors, and that's another opportunity. Or join CAP Friday morning, 10:30, in front of the Trade and Convention Center. There's lots of ways to get out and say what the truth is and to say what kind of a world you want to live in. So thank you, all of you.
Thank you, Ellen. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Connor Pearl. I'm with Leave Out Violence, a youth-based photojournalism group. I've been hearing a lot of problems, which is obviously why we're here, because there's a lot of problems. But coming from a youth-based perspective, what can the youth of Vancouver who will be targeted by the police and authorities do to take a proactive role in the wellness of the city and the people? What can we do that will actually show that we're not against everything that the Olympics stands for? Because the athletes, they don't put these rules down. Like, it's not their fault. They're doing what they're passionate about. But we have to support them at the same time as supporting us and our city, and we need to take care of our own, and we need to protect our own. What are some solutions that we can actually take a proactive role in doing?
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask everyone to maybe take about a minute, answer the questions, and wrap up, because we'll be finishing off now. So maybe start on the end with Dave and work our way this way.
Okay. I want to thank everyone for coming tonight and for the opportunity to speak to the organizers, and thank Ellen as well for being a good ally on City Council and raising the civil liberties issues again and again, as I know she has. And to the youth speaker who was just up there, we would certainly welcome any youth that were interested in participating in the Legal Observer program. But I recognize that that's a very top-down kind of thing, and maybe that's not something that youth would be particularly interested in. But if there was any interest in having a workshop with civil liberties about knowing your rights or how the observers work, and maybe having a youth-run observer program that would also operate in cooperation, that would be something we'd be really interested in. So I'm really glad you raised that issue, and I hope that anyone here who works with youth comes up to speak to me after so we can find ways to get youth involved. Thanks for your comments, everyone.
As well, I'd like to thank everyone for their patience as well. Certainly, I know that's an issue that Olympic opponents come up to quite a lot, the idea that not only just the idea you get that the games are coming anyway, why even bother to say anything, which you get raises the same problem as if the WTO is coming anyway, if Jean Chrétien is coming to town anyway, if Bill Clinton's coming to town anyway, if George Bush is coming to town anyway, why bother protesting? So there's certainly good reasons to do that. And then the issue that the impression is that you're against amateur sport and you're against athletes if you oppose the Olympic industry, if you oppose the way that the Olympics are brought to communities around the world. And I hope that that's certainly not the impression that people would get. As far as youth organizing, I think that there's a lot of great youth organizations in the city and that there's a lot people can do. Certainly knowing your rights and supporting each other around the community as your rights are being threatened by the Olympics are important. And there's also wonderful creative ways of resistance that I'm hoping that people will get involved in. And there was some great, another thing that reflects back to AIPAC that has also been done around the Olympics is simply occupying public space to have sports. Sport does not require massive, huge, purpose-built stadiums and billion-dollar like corporate sponsor budgets for promotion. Sport is accessible. Sport is something everybody can do and everybody can participate in and enjoy and benefit from. And to actually get that out to the public and to the media, that this should be an open, accessible thing, and that if there's an intersection downtown that maybe isn't being used for what it should be probably used for sport. And certainly during AIPAC, there were great street hockey games in front of the president's house, which were wonderful fun for that reason. And they're also healthy, good fitness, and even the Olympics like that. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Am for bringing kind of the all-star team together here.
I just call you guys the Super Friends.
Super Friends. I'm part of his mob on Facebook. I'd like to thank the last question because I think it's probably the most important thing, considering that everybody in this room is of the same ideology. We understand racism, we understand colonialism, we understand poverty, and yet we're an incredibly divided group. And we see it played out over and over again. And one of the problems that we have that the right-wingers don't have is that we don't understand that fact about achieving unity. And young people understand what unity means. And I think, above all, I don't ever consider myself a Canadian. I consider myself part of this community, part of East Vancouver. And I teach that to my kids. And my kids have a really deep understanding of that. And if they want to protect this village that we live in, we have to protect that voice. And that requires young people standing up and telling the rest of us to get our shit together and start being united and act united. And I think we are at a certain period in this time of history that we're able to do that. And I think it's important for people to understand that. And I'm hopeful that it's going to be young people that are going to lead that charge.
Yeah, thank you folks for coming out and sticking it out. I think just where Dave had picked up and in response to what people can do, what youth can do, how people can protect themselves, and also just the earlier question that Amy had talked about in terms of the legacy of the games in light of all the negative things. For me, and I think it also touched on a little bit about what Matt was talking about, is that it's really easy to kind of cast these movements as anti-Olympics, but I think the legacy of the games is also the legacy of resistance and community building that we're building, right? The very fact that we sit in this room here together is something that shows that we're willing to come out and create something that's not just our daily lives and being complicit in the lives and the status quo that we live. And so for me, that's part and parcel of this, is that being able to kind of articulate our opposition to these huge structures that we live in, and that they're not going to end with the games, they're going to continue, is about finding the dignity in struggle and finding that, you know, on a daily basis we can find different ways to affirm a better life for ourselves. And what that looks specifically, you know, there's no kind of huge answer, but the ability to come together and do something about the very things that are impacting us is something that's incredibly scary, but at the same time it's incredibly empowering to kind of really break down those walls that forces us to live these really individualistic, individualized lives. That, as Dave said, this kind of idea that we each have to have our back, and come 2010 we really have to have each other's back, is something that's frightening in the face of these kind of security measures that we're talking about. But it's something, this kind of community and legacy of resistance, that I don't think is the legacy of the games, but is the legacy of what we will build together, whatever social movements will continue, whatever kind of community and dignified way of life that we want to build, is something that I find really promising and hugely optimistic. In the face of, you know, 13,000 cops. And so for me, it's, I don't know if this kind of answers part of that question, but I hear it in terms of, you know, we're kind of opposed to all these things. What are we going to do? And I think there's so many different alternatives, but it's more about if we can come together to find the spirit to do something. And I think that's kind of the largest step that we have to take, because the kind of solutions are so many, and we'll each find them in whatever things appeal to us, but the ability to come together and do something is the most powerful thing that we really can do. And so I think that legacy of resistance that we have in the next 5 months to build is hugely critical, and I look forward to us building it together.
Thanks. I'll just say something really brief, too, which is going to echo what has already been said. But to say, first, thanks for your question, by the way. That was an excellent question. And I would say that the question is actually sort of a challenge in some ways, and I think it's a challenge to all of us. We kind of have like a thing we say at the Thistle sometimes, which is that so often youth projects, youth centers and schools, they talk about getting kids off the street. And I think it actually is a much more interesting thing to say is, how can we get kids back on the street? How can we get them back involved in the world, back involved in their communities, you know? And so I think that's interesting, you know, and I think part of that has to happen through great groups like Love, right? Which has to have, I mean, I think we have to find the courage to not be small-hearted and not to kind of retreat into fear, you know, and to just rent videos for February. You know, is to find some way to find the courage in ourselves, but really actually to help each other find the courage, right, and support each other in having the courage to, you know, to do whatever we think resist means. But also I think the flip side of that, and I think that's what you're, if I could be so bold, is what you're pointing to, is actually celebrate, right? So if that corporate mess is not what we're after, then what is? And if we wait for government, if we wait for politicians, if we wait for our leaders to do it for us, we're going to be waiting a hell of a long time. It's time for us to start, you know, to think of resistance and celebration as the same thing, right? And to think about, well, if that's not the culture we're after, if that's not the city we're after, let's go do it, you know? Let's go get on it. Yeah.
Thanks, everyone, for coming out and for your great attention over the last 2 hours. And thanks, Am, as usual, for your great vision in organizing these. I guess I'll just add a cultural angle, like totally agreeing with everything that's been said. But what are the ways, whether it's to celebrate or go out and make public space? I'm saying space is something that you make. So how about going out with the idea of making public space and making public space through art, making public space through poetry? There's been lots of great groups that sprung up after 2001 and the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, groups like PIPA, Poetry is Public Art. They have a website. Chalk is extremely inexpensive and easy to use. Sidewalks are fantastic things for writing on. There's been guerrilla poster campaigns. There's the group in New York that I was mentioning that does the tours where you can walk from one place to another with the least amount of surveillance cameras, which is like a great way to point out where they are and to point out the way that that public space is being surveilled. So I would also say look to what groups have done in other cities that had Olympics. What were the kind of creative resistances and the creative reworkings that happened in Barcelona that had a very active and smart resistance to it? So looking around, and you know, as everyone's pointed out, the lack of let's say critical media coverage and other voices around the Olympics, to really look around and find the blogs and the Tai and places like that where that give you the other information, because that creeping away of public space and that creeping privatization of space also is tied around information. And I think that's why actually I care more about education now than what I used to, and it's no mystery that education is one of the areas that's really being under attack at the present moment. So looking around to see what's happened in other places and emulating that, making it local, which also then has the advantage of making a connection to place as well. So there's a great book called Guerrilla Art by Jules Boykoff and Kaya Sands, which just documents all the different kinds of creative things that people did after 2001. So I guess what I'm saying is make public space and make public art.
It's a lot easier to go first than it is to go last, but I guess in the interest of balance, I've got both. So thanks a lot for coming tonight. I really appreciated hearing all the perspectives that have been represented and presented here. I just wanted to touch on the last question that was posed to us. I feel like in some ways I can particularly identify with that one, because I'm turning 26 this year, and for some of you that might be really young, but for some of you in the audience that might also be really old. So of the initiatives that I've been involved with over the last few years, I guess one thing that I have learned is to never underestimate what you and a small group of friends can accomplish, whether that be taking up physical space in an intersection, playing a soccer game, or whether it be building a park out at UBC. There are a lot of different ways you can take a stand and make a difference within your communities. I think you also touched on a really interesting point in terms of saying, of acknowledging that there are different perspectives coming forward. And it's also important to pursue those that you are most interested in, just because that is where a lot more passion will be able to fuel your fire in that sense. So definitely don't underestimate the power of yourself and especially the power that youth have within this community, because ultimately, I guess, as younger people, you, we, us, we are going to be living with it for a long time, so let's start envisioning the future that we want to be having. So thanks for coming.
You are tuned to CFRO 102.7 FM, independent, listener-supported radio in Vancouver, Canada. That was the second hour of Right to the City, Civil Liberties, and the 2010 Olympics, recorded at SFU Harbor Center on Monday, September 28, 2009. The panel was organized by the Impact on Community Coalition and hosted by Am Johal. Find out more at iocc.ca.